Thank you, and welcome to our capital markets event. And thank you for attending what will be an interesting and hopefully insightful dialogue and debate today. I would also like to thank my colleagues again for their continued high performance and delivery. In 2016, we have had another terrific year. Part of the purpose of today is to put right the communication mistakes of the past. With hindsight, we should have been clearer when referring to Solvency II and dividends of March 2015. It was simply meant to be a belt and braces disclosure. And in March this year, again on reflection, we should have better explained what our Solvency II coverage ratio of 140% might mean in the context of our dividend. It was never intended to be interpreted as a signal that this was a level at which we would cut our dividend. Simon Gadd will explain this further in his presentation. We should also have improved our disclosure, recognizing the huge variance in interpretation of many issues. We have indeed improved our disclosure today, as you will see. We'd also like to thank several of you within this audience for contributing to this improved disclosure. We circulated these in advance. Our objectives are to answer the relevant issues and questions raised by analysts, investors, and commentators. We also want to recognize that our commitment to deliver, that is, our ambition, has not changed. We want to repeat the financial performance we achieved in 2010 to 2015 in the period 2015 to 2020. We have continued to deliver in respect of our financials, but not in respect of our returns to shareholders. The timetable. We will be making many of our outstanding senior management team available to answer your questions, both during the presentation and afterwards. We have built a focused, high-performing business. We are addressing critical issues for our customers, but also for society. We are market leaders in large, attractive markets and have a unique business model, which integrates asset management, pooling of risk, and long-term investment. Our positive, supportive culture is unique. We succeed through hard work, excellent execution, and most of all, through teamwork. Our focus in attractive, high-growth markets, coupled with excellent execution, results in strong financial performance. We are market leaders in global pension risk transfer, number one in the UK. We are world leaders in LDI and world number five in index. We have successfully entered several new markets. Asset management and pension risk transfer in the US have been a huge success, but also infrastructure, urban regeneration, housing, lifetime mortgages, and SME finance here in the UK. We're also number one in UK retail protection with a 25% market share. However, we can perform better in every division. We have not yet achieved our potential anywhere. Through a combination of good analytical insights and some good luck, we have chosen to build our businesses around long-term structural growth drivers, both macroeconomic and demographic. We are seen as providers of relevant solutions by many economic agents and are a partner of choice by our customers, by our suppliers, governments, and indeed many other institutions. The world's population is simply getting older. There is more need for real assets producing real returns and real jobs. Technological innovation is a positive for Legal & General, as is welfare reform. Our ambition is to repeat a similar operational performance in 2015 to 2020 as we did in 2010 to 2015. Our current financial forecasts for this year have net cash generation around 6% ahead of consensus at around 1.4 billion. One point often ignored but worth noting is that our net cash retained has been around £500 million per year. And indeed, most of that cash is sitting on our balance sheet and delivering a relatively poor return for shareholders. But this additional cash generation has increased our book value per share. To date, we have constantly delivered strong results with double-digit growth in EPS and net cash, coupled with an ROE rising from 14.9% to around 20%. We are decluttering our businesses, exiting those businesses which are not delivering sufficient growth, nor delivering acceptable financial returns, or do not fit with our long-term strategy. We have exited old-fashioned businesses, and we are investing in new, modern, high-growth businesses. We have focused our business from a position of strength. As Mark and Garvin will demonstrate, we have a strong and resilient IFRS, EC, and S2 balance sheet. Our management team will demonstrate the opportunities we have to accelerate our evolution. We are really well positioned to continue to grow. We take on rewarded risk and minimize unrewarded risks. An effective risk management team and a risk management culture is key to our success. Cala has proven to be an exceptional investment and helped to build our presence in housing and urban regeneration, and on any future realization event will support capturing these future opportunities. Our growth, coupled with our low-cost operating models, allows us to deliver excellent returns for shareholders. I'll now hand over to Mark and Garvin.
Okay, thank you, Nigel, and good afternoon, everyone. So in this first slot today, I'm going to explain how we approach the management of our Solvency II position, give you some insights into how our Solvency II balance sheet has progressed in 2016, our first year under the new regulatory regime, and then provide you with some thoughts on how we anticipate the Solvency II net surplus generation progressing in 2017 and beyond. In summary, I'm going to set out how we're able to support both business growth and our progressive dividend policy. Garvin O'Neill, who is our Director of Group Finance, will then provide you with some extra colour on Solvency II sensitivities, as well as setting out our approach to managing liquidity. As you heard from Nigel, the business teams will then take you through how we intend to deliver the business growth. Before we get on to new information, here's a reminder of some details I've shared with you previously. This is the group's capital position on both an economic capital and Solvency II basis at year-end 2015 and half-year 2016. And I draw out three key messages. Firstly, our Solvency II capital requirement, our SCR, at £9 billion was £3.1 billion higher at the half-year than what we assess to be a 1 in 200-year economic capital requirement. This can be thought of as a regulatory buffer. Importantly, however, provided we've correctly assessed our best estimate cash flows into the future, then all of this SCR and other regulatory margins will be released over time. Secondly, our economic capital requirement did not change in the first half of 2016, but the SCR increased by over £1 billion over the 6 months. This reflects the fact that the valuation of the SCR is more volatile than the ECR, which is partly why we hold a buffer above 100% coverage ratio to absorb this volatility. And thirdly, our half-year coverage ratio is 5 percentage points higher after eliminating the SCR associated with our with-profits fund and the assets backing that with-profits SCR, giving us a coverage ratio of 163% on a shareholder basis. You'll be aware that different companies in the UK have adopted different bases for calculating the coverage ratio they disclose to the market. And you've told us that this has served to create unnecessary confusion. So to be helpful, we will adopt the shareholder basis going forwards as our primary disclosure purposes. Moving on then to how we are managing the Solvency II balance sheet in practice to support profitable new business growth and dividends. This slide shows key elements of our forecast 2016 surplus emergence. The expected existing business surplus mainly represents the back book releases from our annuity and insurance businesses, plus the post-tax profits from LGIM, and the return above risk-free rates on the shareholder assets held outside of our matching adjustment portfolio. The next line represents the impact on our overall Solvency II surplus of the new business we have written this year, and I'll come back to this in a minute. We then define Solvency II net surplus in any period to be the expected release from existing business, less the impact of writing new business. And you can see in 2016, we are forecasting that our net surplus will cover the dividend cost by a healthy margin. In any period, we will have market and other movements to arrive at the total Solvency II surplus. But importantly, we would expect these other movements to be no worse than net neutral over time. From here and henceforth, we are confident that Group will generate sufficient surplus to enable us to grow both the business and to pay a progressive dividend. Let me tell you why. A key component is the impact on the Solvency II surplus of writing new business, the new business strain. Let me start by explaining the new business strain associated with our annuity business and the dynamics of our capital-efficient proposition. As we announced last month, we had written £6.3 billion of new annuity business at that date. Although, as Kerrigan will cover later, we have now written rather more than this in 2016, meaning 2016 will be a record year for annuity sales as the strength of our proposition continues to resonate in the pension risk transfer market, both here in the UK and increasingly in the US. Our new business strain on these annuity volumes amounts to less than £200 million. This represents the difference between the premium received and the aggregate of the best estimate liabilities, risk margin, and SCR. The new business strain under Solvency II equates to 2 to 3% of premium in 2016. We then expect to get releases in respect of this business for decades to come, having achieved payback in around 4 years. Clear evidence that Legal & General can write profitable new annuity business in volume in a Solvency II world. Later, Kerrigan and Chris Knight will provide you with additional colour on how this is being achieved and our further growth opportunities for LGR going forwards. Our diversified business model then provides a further material advantage over, for example, a monoline annuity provider. Our market-leading and profitable UK protection franchise creates a day-one surplus, as Solvency II allows us to include the expected future profits from that business. We have to hold an SCR against this newly created value of in-force, but that SCR enjoys a significant diversification benefit against our annuity business in particular. Hence, you can see we get a day one benefit from our new protection business, but with much smaller releases thereafter, a very different profile compared to our annuity business. This slide then brings together the new business from our annuity and insurance divisions, as well as from workplace pensions, savings, and our US term assurance business. In aggregate, all of our non-annuity new business provides a positive contribution to our Solvency II surplus on day one, giving us a payback on total new business strain of around 3 years. Our capital-efficient business strategy operating in practice. Moving to 2017 and beyond, what do we expect the key characteristics of our Solvency II balance sheet to be? We're just completing the annual update of our five-year business plan, and in respect to Solvency II, this shows our back book will continue to throw off substantial releases to surplus, which only reduce slowly over time and last for decades to come. You'll not be surprised to know that we expect to grow our business going forwards, including the size of our annuity business. However, our capital-efficient model means we can and will grow the business in a way that only creates a limited Solvency II strain. Having done so, that will create its own new incremental back book, which in turn will pay back in a small number of years, followed by surpluses being generated for many, many years thereafter. Elsewhere in our diversified business model, our growth ambitions for LGIM and LGC mean that we expect them to deliver increased profit contributions, which in turn will also contribute to our Solvency II surplus. Overall, we are targeting the average annual growth in our Solvency II net surplus generation over the next 5 years to be in the mid to high single-digit percentage range. Put simply, we can deliver both new business growth and our progressive dividend policy in a Solvency II world. And with that, I'll hand over to Garvin.
Good afternoon, everybody. Looking at both our IFRS and Solvency II balance sheets, we start in a very strong position. Over our five-year planning horizon, we see both balance sheets growing strongly, with the net equity of our IFRS balance sheets growing considerably faster than our Solvency II balance sheet. This reflects the incremental prudence that is within the Solvency II balance sheet, which ultimately will be released over the lifetime of the contracts. From both an IFRS and Solvency II perspective, our overall balance sheet is tightly managed. This is achieved through the combination of a strong asset liability matching mandate, regular monitoring, and scenario testing. For shareholder equity, a well-diversified asset strategy, a conservative debt leverage profile, and robust liquidity management deliver good shareholder protection and returns. Specific to our Solvency II owned funds components, the significant majority of it is high-quality Tier 1 capital. This Tier 1 capital alone exceeds our capital requirement by $2.6 billion, or more than 28%. At 30 June 2016, our own funds amounted to $13.7 billion, with surplus of $5.3 billion. A selection of management actions on both assets and liabilities can be deployed as and when required to further support this strong capital position. Within these management actions is the opportunity to use our significant Tier 2 capacity. We run a conservative debt leverage profile with debt maturities no more frequently than every 2 years. We've maintained over many years a relatively constant ratio of debt to equity, with the majority of this debt being subordinated. This works well from a Solvency II perspective. We have found that maintaining our adjusted leverage ratio at or around 30% serves us well in terms of cost of capital, return on capital employed, and credit agency rating. Our credit rating remains strong at AA-, recognising the strength of our balance sheet combined with the strong risk management framework applied across the business, which you will hear more about later. Since the official introduction of Solvency II, we have only presented the market with two measures of our own funds and SCR. Between these two measurement points, we have seen an 11% movement in the coverage ratio. This is despite the fundamentals of business remaining largely unchanged. Over the first half year, we experienced significant downward movements in the long-term interest rate curve, a narrowing of spreads, significant weakening in sterling, and positive movements in the FTSE. Each of these has impacted the balance sheet in different ways without changing the economics underlying the exposures held on the balance sheet. Added to the impact of these market movements on our half-year 2016 ratio was the predictable impact of our dividend. We pay approximately 70% of our dividend in H1, equivalent to 6 percentage points of coverage. During the first half of 2016 and continuing into the second half, we have deployed management actions only where it has been economically sensible to do so. These included hedging some parts of our US positions, hedging a portion of our traded portfolios, and rebalancing the credit exposures where we saw opportunity to improve the overall credit exposure strength at an economically sensible cost. Since the half year, a lot of these economic movements have partially reversed. We do, however, expect continued volatility in the economic environment with the consequential impact on our coverage ratio. As Mark mentioned, we hold a buffer above the 100% coverage ratio to absorb volatility in line with our risk appetite to allow us to manage the business on an economic basis rather than a strict Solvency II balance sheet metric. Across the shareholder and non-linked subset of our balance sheet, we carry a well-diversified portfolio of assets with a significant credit exposures spread across multiple sectors, geographies, currencies, and ratings. We maintain an average A- asset credit rating on this portfolio. The shareholder portfolio of assets is managed and monitored extremely closely to identify opportunities and actions to be taken. It is modelled frequently across multiple scenarios to determine the impact on the balance sheet on movements in the assets. We have a strong track record over the past 20 plus years in managing default and downgrade experience. We have only seen one default and limited downgrades to below investment grade over the last 5 years. This in the context of a default allowance in our IFRS reserves of circa $2.2 billion before including our additional default reserve of circa $500 million. Within our Solvency II calculations, we allow for defaults and downgrades mainly through the application of the fundamental spread maintained by EIOPA, mandated by EIOPA and the PRA. This is set at a much higher level than our best estimate of future defaults. And this is one of the key differences between the economic capital and Solvency II balance sheets shown by Mark earlier. We have shown on this slide the scale of the credit portfolio and private property assets within the shareholder portfolio, which amounts to $55 billion. We've also shown the portion of assets in different ratings and a split, split by specific sector. Note that this is a group-level view. Much of this is similar to the information shown in the report and accounts at mid-year, but with some updating to allow for a reallocation of issuers where we previously aggregated within securitizations and debentures to the underlying sectors and the inclusion of private property investments of $2.5 billion. You will hear more detail about this shortly. One of the stresses that we run on this portfolio is to determine how holdings would perform in the event of a three-notch downgrade across all ratings on 20% of the portfolio and calculate the impact on our Solvency II balance sheet. We show the impact of this stress on the Solvency II balance sheet. We applied a somewhat purist approach in assuming that following the downgrade, we immediately rebalance back to the original portfolio through the sale of the downgraded bonds. In practice, we would look to manage the impact through an asset-by-asset review and management of the position. Indeed, this is the approach we have taken in the past, with typically a better outcome as compared to the immediate sale. As mentioned earlier, from an IFRS perspective, we carry significant reserves within our technical provisions to cover the impact of defaults through the cycle, such that our balance sheet remains strong through stresses, which protects the balance sheet from having to take uneconomic actions. Completing our balance sheet strength is our overall, or complementing our balance sheet strength is our overall liquidity strength. We look at our liquidity position over our planning horizon across five different bases. These are free liquidity, internal cash generation, Solvency II surplus emerging in liquid form, and IFRS cash and near cash. Each of these is monitored in order to check that from all the liquidity perspectives, we have the required flexibility to enable us to react when opportunities arise. Noteworthy is the level of ongoing liquidity that is within shareholder funds. This allows us to maintain a discipline that internal dividends are received at group level well in advance of the declaration of our external dividend. And this is helped by our simple structure and business model. These amounts are held separately from the balance of funds that we hold in order to be in a position to quickly deploy funds to take advantage of opportunities as they arise. I will now hand over to Simon and Anton, who will outline our approach to managing risk.
Good afternoon, everyone. As Group CRO, I'm paid to worry about the future, to ensure we understand, manage, and can tolerate the downsides for the risks we take. My remit covers the full range of financial, operational, and conduct risks. I'm assisted by both a team of specialists in specific risk types, credit risk, market risk, operational risk, etc., who look across the whole group to aggregate exposures. I'm also supported by a team of divisional CROs that sit within the engine room of the business, advising and challenging the divisional management to optimise our risk-taking activity. As well as the risks inherent in our day-to-day activity, my team worry about the external and emerging risks that may disrupt our strategy and ensure the business have well-developed mitigation strategies and contingency plans. One recent example was the EU referendum, where detailed scenario planning and hedging enabled us to be well prepared for the short-term implications of either outcome from the referendum. Looking forward to the resulting Brexit negotiations, Legal & General have limited direct business exposure to trading in Europe. So our scenario planning continues to focus on the potential implications for our asset exposures and any regulatory and operational implications. My job starts with ensuring the board has understood and articulated its risk appetite, both at a group level and in respect of each different risk type, and advising whether the risk appetite and strategy are aligned. We then monitor to ensure our risk exposures are managed within this appetite. We have an appetite for risks which we believe are awarded. We understand and have the capability to manage, and we have the tolerance for the downside. These would include credit, equity, property, mortality and longevity risks, where we express a positive appetite within defined tolerances and levels of diversification. For other risks, which are inherent in our business model, we have more limited tolerance, and we mitigate these risks where it is practical and economically sensible to do so. Some risks have a more onerous capital requirement under Solvency II. This chart shows the split of capital exposure by risk type and highlights that credit and market risks dominate our balance sheet. However, the most important point to understand is the majority of this credit risk is taken within the annuity fund, which has unique ALM characteristics. Our annuity liabilities are very illiquid, and therefore we are very rarely a forced seller of assets. So we predominantly hold credit and other fixed income assets for the cash flows they generate. We are less interested in their current market value. We hedge our interest and inflation risk against our IFRS liabilities, which does leave some residual non-economic exposure in the Solvency II balance sheet. This does therefore bring in some artificial volatility due to movements in the swap rates curve, which the board is prepared to tolerate while we have a substantial surplus buffer. Economically, we are really only interested in defaults, which change the cash flows, or downgrades, which increase the risk of the cash flows not arriving. As Garvin set out, managing the downgrade risk associated with BBB assets is particularly important, as downgrading to sub-investment grade is penal from a capital perspective and a clear indicator of heightened default risk. Anton will explain how we manage this risk in a moment. But ultimately, this is one of the key reasons why we hold a surplus buffer above the 100% coverage ratio, to provide scope to absorb losses and give us freedom to take controlled risk. We are looking to further diversify our credit exposure and take advantage of our illiquid liabilities by growing our portfolio of direct investments in LGR. This gives us some exposure to property ownership. But again, it is important to understand that the property is always secured by a long-term lease to high-quality counterparties. Or the property is purely security in the event of default of a counterparty to which we have provided long-term financing. We are not planning to sell the property, so short-term property market value fluctuations are not our primary concern. We are interested in the rental stream to match our liabilities. And most important to me is a robust underwriting, structuring, and internal credit rating process for these long-term investments. The Internal Credit Rating Committee sits within my second-line function, independent of the deal-makers, with all of its members having several decades of experience from the mainstream rating agencies and their methodologies. In terms of liquidity management, we hold ample gilts and cash to cover extreme liquidity and collateral requirements. Around 20% of our surplus capital is invested by LGC in more illiquid assets. However, unlike a bank, many of the potential calls on our capital or surplus do not require short-term liquidity. For example, whilst the pandemic does require liquidity, for which we have very liquid assets available, conversely, a longevity stress does not require liquid assets. Our risk management strategy for insurance risks is very similar. We take risks which are rewarded, we understand and can tolerate the downside. We limit the downside through reinsurance and ensuring sufficient diversification in our pool. We have a deep understanding of longevity risk and the science of life expectancy through a wide range of expertise across statistical analysis, demography and actuarial modelling, epidemiologists and experts in medical science. The critical difference from market risks is longevity risk moves very slowly, so there's plenty of time to respond. The risk is currently performing well versus pricing, but the onerous Solvency II risk margin requirements currently make adding new longevity risk economically unattractive, so we've moved to a more syndicated model. Mortality risk is a useful diversifier against longevity risk, particularly in tail scenarios, although we are careful not to over-rely on this. The key risks to manage are underwriting quality, which we continue to invest in our capability, but have the advantage of scale and high volumes of claims data to analyse and feedback into pricing. The Brexit political process will be slow and unpredictable, but it's just one of many political, economic and regulatory uncertainties present in today's environment. 2016 has shown more than ever before how planning for the unexpected is valuable. So we have a range of monitoring actions and contingency plans in place. As Group CRO, there are two key issues I continue to monitor. Firstly, the Solvency II regime is still bedding down. It has increased the volatility and complexity in our balance sheet, which we're still learning to manage. I thought it would be worthwhile to clarify our risk appetite here. We want to hold a surplus buffer above the regulatory requirement of 100% coverage ratio to give the management sufficient freedom to deliver our strategy. The 140% coverage ratio referred to at our last year-end results has been misinterpreted by some commentators. It is best described as a threshold for increased monitoring. We have a wide range of management actions available, and depending on the circumstances and causes of the fall, we will decide whether to act, and if so, which actions to utilise. These actions include, for example, asset de-risking, further reinsurance, restricting new business, or raising debt. Assuming the fall in coverage ratio is due to a specific event, as opposed to a declining trend, then these actions would be considered before any review of dividends. Now, clearly, there is a continuum. If the coverage ratio falls closer to 100%, the likelihood and extent of management actions we will deploy will increase. For example, hedging our interest rate exposures to non-economic elements of the Solvency II balance sheet would only apply if our coverage ratio was getting too close to 100%. The second key issue from both an ALM and Solvency II perspective is managing the risk of credit defaults and downgrades. This is therefore an opportune moment for me to hand over to Anton Issa, LGIM's UK Head of Global Fixed Income, who has managed our annuity credit portfolio for several years.
Thank you, Simon. Good afternoon. To give you a deeper understanding of how we manage credit risk, I'm going to give you some background to the team, discuss the investment philosophy, and cover the key characteristics of the portfolio. Here's some background to the team. The annuity fund draws on resources across LGIM's real assets and global fixed income team. The £51 billion fund represents approximately one-third of the total assets under management. The remainder is predominantly institutional clients with a bias to UK and US pension funds. Given our client base, the vast majority of our mandates target long-term liabilities, which shapes the investment culture of the team, which I'll discuss in the next few slides. We have an experienced team of 153 investment professionals. Performance has been excellent, and we've received numerous industry awards. Ultimately, the objective of this mandate is to generate stable, through-the-cycle returns to fund long-term liabilities. As Simon said out earlier, the mark-to-market of the portfolio is not particularly relevant. However, the quality of the portfolio over time is crucial. This mandate draws on both our long-term macro views and our deep experience in credit research. Our long-term thematic approach drives the sector and geographic allocation, while constant monitoring ensures we rotate the portfolio through time and seek to add value on a global relative value basis. Given the long-term nature of this mandate, it's crucial we dedicate the majority of our analytical resources to understanding the key themes over the next 5 to 10 years. While portfolio rotation can reshape the portfolio, it's the structural outlook that drives the allocation over time. Thanks to this focus, our team was early to understand the migration of the banking crisis to European sovereign risk and have been ahead of consensus in identifying risks posed to emerging markets in more recent times. Importantly, we believe that we are well placed to identify and manage future risks for global markets. Declining demographics and a heavy global debt burden are structural factors that have weighed on growth and credit metrics. The implications of these secular drivers are enormous, both in terms of distortionary monetary policy and political instability. Indeed, such structural forces increase the chance of a material downside tail risk, potentially worse than a normal recession. To mitigate this potential outturn, it's crucial these long-term anchors flow through the characteristics of the portfolio. Consequently, we have skewed the portfolio towards counter-cyclical, asset-heavy sectors with limited financial or European peripheral risk. Our analysts are deeply integrated into our investment process, providing valuable inputs, company inputs into our debate. These themes also flow through their approach to credit analysis, as they focus on stable, cash flow generating businesses with real assets and quality management. So how does this investment philosophy actually impact the breakdown of the portfolio? On this slide, we provide the detailed split of the portfolio across public and private markets. 13.2% of the portfolio is invested by the real assets team, with the balance being invested in public fixed income markets. In addition, to help provide more detailed sector exposure, we've reallocated issuers that were previously under securitizations and debentures to their underlying sectors. The portfolio is globally diversified, with over 1,000 issuers across public and private credit markets. There's a lot of information on this slide, so it's useful to think about the portfolio in five broad categories. Firstly, 17.2% is invested in sovereigns, supranationals, and sub-sovereigns. The vast majority of this is held in gilts. Secondly, we can group together our exposure to financials. Of that 13.4%, 94% is either secured or senior. The subordinated bank exposure of 0.9% compares to a double-digit percentage pre the global financial crisis. The third group is the 14.3% exposure to utilities, of which the majority is regulated UK names like National Grid, Thames Water, etc. The fourth grouping maps across the more traditional non-financial corporate sectors, from consumer goods and services to industrials. This category is 29% of the portfolio. Given the macro risks I described earlier, the bias in this part of our portfolio is to be exposed to large US names with balance sheets that can sustain a material decline in global growth. A large proportion of this portfolio is single A or above. The final category combines our real economy classification from property through to infrastructure and social housing. This represents 22.8% of the portfolio and is asset-backed with low LTVs. Given our clear focus on counter-cyclical exposure, it's worth looking at the approximately 10% of the fund exposed to more cyclical sectors like industrials and oil and gas. Within these sectors, we focus again on companies with automatic stabilizers, with a particular emphasis on vertically integrated oil majors that have a natural hedge when oil prices fall. Our exposure to industrials effectively encompasses the General Electrics and Siemens of the credit universe. In essence, global companies with balance sheet buffers capable of absorbing external shocks. As Garvin highlighted earlier, it's the triple B part of the portfolio that requires the greatest focus in the team, given the capital implications of a downgrade to sub-investment grade. This requires constant monitoring by the portfolio managers and the analysts, incorporating key components of the investment process. Firstly, in addition to group-wide quantitative risk models managed by Simon's team, credit analysts incorporate specific macro downside scenarios to stress potential ratings migration. They take predefined downside macro scenarios of the next 12 to 24 months and use them to stress test individual credits within the portfolio. Each analyst then assesses the impact that scenario will have on credit ratings, providing valuable information to the portfolio management team. Secondly, the feedback between the strategists, portfolio managers, and analysts is also formalized through monthly sector reviews and single-name deep dives across the team, where we constantly challenge our fundamental views on sectors and individual positions. Stress testing and constantly challenging ourselves is a crucial part of the process to ensure we deliver stable through-the-cycle returns with a clear focus on potential downside risks. With that, I'll hand over to Nigel for the group Q&As.
Thank you. What we're going to try and do is structure the Q&A so that people ask the questions just to the six speakers that we've had so far. The individual sectors, individual business lines, will present next, and we'll take all the questions on the individual business lines in the second half of the presentation. So questions to Mark, myself, Simon, Anton, and Garvin, please. Oliver, followed by John. You were so quick there, the team didn't have the microphone.
Oliver Steele at Deutsche Bank. Just one question. How does the growth in the net surplus generation feed through into the dividend growth?
I think we're trying to de-link the Solvency II metrics from the IFRS metrics. And indeed, the dividend policy, as stated, is on, I think, slide 92 in your pack. If you go to the back, you can read what that is. It's primarily driven by net cash, medium term, and operating earnings over the medium term. And so there is no direct correlation between the net surplus generation and the dividend. John? Followed by Alan.
Thank you. John Hawking from Morgan Stanley. You've given a sort of good update on the disclosure in terms of the flow and how you're covered in terms of the surplus and the dividend. Can you try and link for us, please, how the flow in the stock works? You know, how should we think about the capacity of this business to actually grow the annuity business, maybe in a downside scenario, and what is the sort of appetite and how resilient is that to a shock? You know, are you going to be able to carry on writing the sort of volume you've been writing if we see spreads widen, if pricing deteriorates? You know, how should we think about linking the two, the flow and the stock?
No, I think I'd prefer, to actually, if Kerrigan answered that question in a second, because it's a very individual, specific question, and some of that's covered in his presentation. So if that's okay, John, I'll take that in the second half.
Thanks, Alan Devlin from Barclays. Two questions. First of all, I think on Mark's slide 15, we say the market moves offset by the other movements. Does that include your management actions? We do not expect management actions to be kind of positive over time, given it's within your control and the things you can do. And then second question on you kind of mentioned the Tier 2 headroom. You know, what type of headroom do you think you have on Tier 2, both in a normal environment and then in a stress environment if you did have to manage capital? Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. So in my speech, I use the phrase no worse than net neutral over time, making the point, Alan, I would expect those things to be broadly beneficial over time, but in any one year, clearly market volatility inherent in the balance sheet will mean that could go in the other direction. So you're right, clearly we're working on things which will improve the capital position rather than making it worse. So but clearly I can't guarantee that in every year, hence my phraseology around no worse than net neutral over time.
Wouldn't have been the phraseology I'd have used, but actually
I'd like to be precise. In terms of Tier 2 headroom, and clearly, first thing I'll say before we get to that, Alan, in terms of debt capacity, clearly we want an efficient balance sheet, but we're not looking to kind of raise lots and lots of debt to fund the massive growth, whatever. We want to maintain an efficient debt to equity ratio in the balance sheet. But you know, if we needed to, then as we stand today, we have getting on for £1 billion worth of headroom in terms of Tier 2. But clearly, as that balance sheet grows over time, as we get a bigger SCR, a lot of the metrics are driven off the regulatory SCR. So as that gets bigger, so the capacity gets bigger with it.
Can we take Greg and Andy, whichever? We'll go.
Yes, so Greg Pearson, KBW. You made a comment about Cala, and just reading between the lines, sounds like there's a potential transaction there. I was wondering whether that would be material, how it would affect Solvency II, et cetera. That's question one. The second one is thanks for the 5-year guidance, ORI, Solvency II surplus. In the context of a progressive dividend, does that mean you're targeting a stable Solvency II ratio, or is that going to reduce over time or increase within that model? And then the third question is, in terms of your credit ratings, obviously AA is much more onerous than the BBB on the Solvency II. So I was wondering, what are the, if you've got any feedback, current thinking of the rating agencies, or areas of risk within those models?
I'll take the first one, Mark, and you take the second two. I think when we purchased Cala, there was a condition in the documentation and the agreement that there would be a realization event in 2017 and 2018. So we're just flagging that is a potential outcome.
Okay, yeah, also on the net service, as net surplus.
It wouldn't be material in the context of solvency, but it would be beneficial to solvency.
Yeah, depends what we do to reinvest the money, Greg. I mean, obviously, if we realise an equity into cash, that's beneficial. But if we then reinvest it into something else, then round we go again. So, in terms of the net surplus generation and the impact that has on coverage capacity, clearly, I didn't give the coverage ratio up there. Just give you a bit of a clue here. Clearly, if you grow the business, that new business will add some SCR. So we would expect broadly the coverage ratio over the 5 years to be broadly stable. And on the rating agency's impact of the ratio of triple Bs and how we manage that, at the end of the day, Anton took quite a lot of detail there, but clearly the things that we worry about, as well. We recognise, as Simon said, that our biggest risk by far is credit risk on the balance sheet, therefore, how we manage that, the diversification, the quality of the team's performance over time, that is all relevant to the rating agencies as well. So I would think the things that Anton took you through are very much the things that the rating agencies worry about and give us credit for as well.
Hi, thanks so much. Andy Hughes from Macquarie. I guess a follow-up question on the solvency ratio. I got the impression you were kind of trying to play down the solvency ratio under Solvency II going forward. I know 2 to 3% is the annuity strain, but what would it be at 160%? Because clearly it wouldn't be 160% of 2 to 3%. It could be a much bigger number. And the second question is, I guess, on the kind of credit risk capacity of the group, obviously it's 50% in the 52% in the slides. Is that the kind of limitation as to how big the business can get? Or is the board not worried about how much credit risk you put on relative to the size of the group? Thanks.
Yeah, on the first one, Andy, the impact of, the strain itself is, that I showed there is broken down between incremental SCR and then the incremental own funds we get to offset that SCR. So you're quite right. And clearly, if we write down, lay down new annuity business, that does create additional solvency capital requirement. I would refer to my answer to Greg's question, which is over time, that we still expect the coverage ratio to remain broadly flat over time. So we are maintaining the ability to create enough own funds to keep the coverage ratio in a very good place. Well, I'll give you enough colour for now. We gave 169 at year end, we gave 158 at the half year. So we know roughly what ballpark we're talking about there.
Yeah, I think the board does reflect on how much risk we're taking, and there's a whole series of risk parameters which Simon develops, and maybe you can just go through those at some length during one of the periods we have for break. But in general, we don't see as a constraint for growth anything that's currently in our planning scenario, in that the amount of opportunities that we have, we feel we have the capital available and sufficient flexibility in all of our balance sheets to deliver that growth, consistent with the direction of travel that both Mark, myself, and my other colleagues have outlined. Andrew.
Good afternoon. A couple of questions. Between the net cash generation of 1.4 billion and the 1.1 billion of net surplus generation is 300 million. Now, that I assume is made up of experience variances, but also the ongoing organic capital requirement for the business you've written. And I was wondering whether you could give us a figure for what the ongoing capital requirement you see annually on the businesses. And then secondly, Nigel, you said something about cash being retained on balance sheet and not earning a particularly good return. I noticed you sold a lot of things. You reorganized into four divisions and left two of your businesses out of those divisions, the UK P&C business and mature savings. Do you ever see a sense where you could look to return some of these disposal proceeds?
That's making Mr. Broadley chuckle in the front row there. So we've never actually, myself, I'm not a huge fan of share buybacks, which is kind of the return of capital, and we're delivering huge returns for shareholders at the moment. We haven't explicitly considered disposing of the divisions that you talked about, but clearly the framework is a framework for the group that we've had with the board on what divisions we should retain and which divisions we should sell. We sold, as it were, a lot of the low-hanging fruit. As you'll see in the next section, some of these businesses are performing incredibly well at the moment and therefore deserve to be part of the group, and we continue to invest for growth. We're very long cash at the moment. I myself feel a little bit uncomfortable about the amount of cash that we have at the group and that we should be trying to redeploy that cash given the amount of returns that we can earn for shareholders. And so we need more ideas from my colleagues rather than less ideas on how we can spend that capital. I think if we ever got to the stage where we ended up selling a few more divisions and ended up with even more cash, then at that point I suspect the board will ask us to go away and consider whether we're just too cash heavy and that we can finance the growth with very low strain that we have at the moment quite easily, and therefore we should look at alternatives like buying back shares. But it wouldn't be my personal preference, but it's one that I suspect our board may well challenge the executive to go away and have a look at. Mark?
Yep. So just on your question around the difference between net cash generation and net surplus generation, clearly one's an IFRS measure based primarily on Solvency I, whereas the other one clearly is a Solvency II metric. And just to, without you suck eggs, Andrew, you recognise that, you know, Solvency I technical provisions do allow for some prudence, but not the capital on top of that, whereas clearly in Solvency II, and we're talking about the whole 1 in 200 capital requirement. So at its core, provided we've got the cash flows right over time, this is economic profit will be the same under both measures. So it's all about the shape and timing of the emergence of those cash flows. And I would just point you to the most obvious difference being that the new business shape is just different. I mean, I've given you a number today, broadly in Solvency II land, with respect to new business strain of around 150 million in the current year. We're not clearly giving you a new business surplus number for IFRS in the results today, but Nigel did give you a 1.4 billion pounds net cash generation in total. Now, within that, clearly the big delta does come from the fact we have written very profitable new business in 2016. So really the biggest difference is recognition and the cash flows associated with the writing of new business, where one, we've got 150 million negative, the other one you can pretty much back solve is pretty much most of the rest of the difference. So, but again, importantly, in the end, economic profit is the same on both bases. So it's just all about the timing and emergence and the shape of that, of those cash flows.
Simon, next. Oh. On, take turns.
Sorry, I seem to have grabbed the mic first. It's Abid Hussain from Credit Suisse. Just one question, if I can. Could you just briefly talk about the difference in new business strain for back book annuity deals versus traditional bulks?
I think, again, that's a very specific question. We'll get Carrigan to answer that because he's got a lot of data in his pack. And if that's okay, we'll answer that one there. Okay, I think we've finished all the questions. Oh, no, we haven't. Greg, you're back.
One more.
I just want to have your thinking on this. I mean, the last 5 years you focused on your net cash generation metrics and you spoke about the dividend. And when IFRS phase, and you know, annuity is a long-term business, and I assume you're in this game for the long term. Under IFRS 2, that's going to change to some kind of market consistent EV, i.e. similar to the Solvency II basis. You're currently using Solvency I. I mean, why are we still worried about this metric that's going to disappear in 3 years' time? I mean, why is your thinking still based around it? Should we not be moving on to Solvency II or some kind of view on where IFRS phase two is going?
No, I think that's a very good question, Greg. I think there are two or three different parts to that answer. One is Solvency II is just bedding down at the moment. IFRS is a methodology well understood by our shareholders, well understood by our business, and we spend a lot of time modelling the business on that basis and on an EC basis, and Solvency II is just one of the metrics. The new accounting standards are several years off, and how they come in and how they'll be interpreted will require a huge amount of work from my finance colleagues before we come to some new metric which is not yet invented on a policy which is not yet known. So we're not that clever to be able to do that. If any of my colleagues want to give a better answer than that during the interim, and I'll point you towards Garvin. thank you for all the questions. We've got a short break now, and where you can ask.
Nope, Bernie.
Oh, we're going to Bernie. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. I've got a. Sorry. We're going to Bernie.
A very short break.
Yeah. I'd just like to introduce Bernie and John. Bernie Hickman is known to some of you, but not to all of you. Bernie just did a fantastic job running retail protection in the. In the UK, did an amazing job helping me and guiding me through Solvency II in the early days, and it's just an amazing job of setting up and getting the lifetime mortgage and the individual annuity business powering ahead in the UK. John Hyde won't be known to any of you, I suspect, at the moment. John has done a huge amount of work in the digital space and has joint responsibility now for developing our digital efforts in the UK, in the US, and indeed in Asia. Has done an amazing job at both GI and retail protection here in the UK. A couple of other bits I think we could have done a bit better on, but John can answer those questions in the break. So I'll hand over to Bernie and John.
Great, thanks, Nigel. That was a great introduction in the end, wasn't it? But, and it's great to see many familiar faces again and to speak to you in my new role leading LGI. Because Legal & General Insurance has recently been formed to create another global business with a growth strategy to deliver earnings that complement those from other divisions. LGI has a turnover of over £2.2 billion and provides life insurance, critical illness cover, and income protection insurance for over 7 million people. It's made up of three distinct customer markets. Our UK retail protection business has built multiple competitive advantages, mostly via market-leading deployment of technology. This is a business I know well, as Nigel has just alluded to. I worked in it for 10 years, five of those as the managing director. Our UK group protection business has a 17% market share with some established credentials in getting employees back to work following sickness. However, work is required to build more sustainable competitive advantages in this market, ensuring consistent delivery of earnings. And in the United States, Legal & General America is focused on providing term life policies via broker general agents. John Hyde, who Nigel also introduced, is Managing Director of Legal & General Direct, and he's going to describe in more detail the nature of LGI's competitive digital strengths. But before I hand you over to John, I just wanted to take you through the overall financials for LGI and comment briefly on some of the recent performance trends. Over the last few years, net cash has been growing as the overall size of the book has increased. However, changes to modelling for reinsurance contracts in 2015 and adverse group protection claims have reduced operating profit in 2016. This is the new rebase level from which the business is expected to grow in 2017 and onwards. One of the many attractive features of the retail protection business, as Mark has already referred to, is that new business actually generates surplus Solvency II own funds. This is a very tangible feature of the diversification benefit of Legal & General writing insurance business. We can assist LGR by generating some of the capital that it needs to write annuity business. In combination, we can generate a more attractive shareholder return than either a pure insurance writer or a monoline annuity business. In UK retail protection, we've been pursuing a digital strategy for almost two decades, with the launch of our first online application for term insurance in the year 2000. And our future growth strategy is focused on replicating the success of our retail protection business in other customer markets. And I'll hand you over to John.
Thanks, Bernie. The strength of the retail protection business is that it's market-leading in every area. It has great product, with competitive pricing delivered through excellent service through the widest range of distributors, as illustrated here. Direct business, the area I'm responsible for, has seen strong growth over recent years and now makes up 20% of our business. We are building a best-in-class digital marketing function, enabling cost-effective customer acquisition alongside building a digital ecosystem that enables customers to research, buy, and service their products through any digital medium they choose. Our technology has also enabled excellent customer service with market-leading point-of-sale decisions, making it ever easier for customers and advisors to do business with us. Our digital approach is vital to successful partnering with a wide range of distributors. More importantly, our systems have been designed to provide high-quality risk management and a wealth of rich data, which provides cutting-edge analysis to refine our underwriting approach. The quality and sophistication of our underwriting, backed up with evidence from our data, has given reinsurers the confidence to price reinsurance premiums ever lower, as you can see from the top graph. Lower costs, shown in the bottom graph, plus lower reinsurance premiums, have enabled us to grow market share while still delivering good profit margins with low risk. A great combination for our shareholders. Our focus going forward is to export our UK digital capability to other markets, in the US being the first priority. We already have a well-established, strong, and integrated business in the USA, with LGA working closely with LGR and LGIM America. The US life market is large, should be larger, and is digitally underdeveloped. Our goal is to enable customers in the US to buy a life policy online in a matter of minutes, as opposed to the 30 or so days, which is the current industry standard. In short, combining our core, long-established insurer capabilities in the UK and the US with a new digital age model will unlock profitable and scale growth. I'll now hand you back to Bernie.
Thanks, John. Digital transformation is essential to prevent disruptive new entrants destroying established businesses. If you stand still, you become the next blockbuster DVD hire business. Becoming the next Netflix in our chosen customer markets is the only sensible strategy and a great opportunity. And digital doesn't need to come with tens of millions of IT spend and a gigantic change program that invariably overruns and underdelivers. Our recent experience in launching into the lifetime mortgage market is a case study in how a small, focused, high-performing team can transform a bolt-on acquisition into a market-leading digital lender with a modest budget in a short space of time. Phase one, between March and June last year, involved rebuilding the entire IT infrastructure, replatforming the admin system, relaunching a market-beating range of products, and rebranding the business, and the IT bill didn't even reach £500,000. Now, rapidly developing a digital business like this has actually been great fun, and it's a blueprint that I'll be looking to take into LGI. Looking ahead, we'll continue innovating to drive growth in the UK retail protection premiums and profits. In addition, we'll be deploying our strengths into other markets. One of these will be UK group protection, which does require action to address some current areas of poor performance. Our key focus and main growth opportunity is accelerating the digital transformation of our US life insurance business, including diversifying distribution and products. And without distracting from our US activities, we have longer-term growth plans in other carefully selected markets with the greatest potential for growth through digital disruption. Regions and countries with fast-growing insurance markets but largely analog business models such as Southeast Asia, the type of markets we'll be exploring. With no interest in building old-world agency and bank assurance models, our focus will be next-generation digitally-enabled distribution. The goal is clear: deliver diversified earnings growth through technology and innovation that complements the growth being delivered by LGR and LGIM. I look forward to sharing the next chapters of the Legal and General Insurance story with you as they unfold over the coming years. And now I hand you back to Nigel to cover our general insurance business. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. A couple of things. We're joined today by John Kingman, who's our new chairman, and we're delighted to have him on board. We've also got Philip Broadley here, who's not only a non-executive director, he's also chairman of our audit committee. So any of your particular questions, I was thinking, Greg, that Philip might be the person to address them, since Garvin's given me 20 quid since the last time we got together. Bernie's moved away, as he mentioned, from the lifetime mortgage business, which had record sales in the month that he left the business. So. But our general insurance, mortgage club and surveying business have all had a very good and strong financial performance year to date. Our mortgage club is on track to deliver £50 billion of mortgage origination, and the surveying business 500 surveys in 2016. And we're really pleased to have won 4 new accounts in GI, which should add to 30 to 40 million of GWP next year. And the growth of GI Direct is another example of our digital capability. On that note, I'd like to say for the second time we're about to have a break, and that all of the management team will be available to answer further questions during that break, and hopefully we'll get everybody back so we can hear the second chapter, which is each of the businesses going through their particular strategy and performance. Thank you. Good to see that about 95% of the people who are here for the first half are here for the second half, and like most things, it's a game of two halves. I think you saw the boys in the back carrying the ball in the first half reasonably well, but in the second half we've got the forwards who are going to win the game for us. Yeah,
We saw that at Twickenham on Saturday, a great game. We'll now cover our three asset gathering businesses, LGIM, LGC and LGR, who collectively contributed 76% of our operating profit in H1 2016. Not only did these businesses share strong execution capabilities, there is tremendous synergy and teamwork. And this teamwork, as I mentioned earlier, is key to our success. The strong linking between our three asset gathering businesses is illustrated in this slide. As you will see, our unique skills in asset management, risk pooling, and investment in and the creation of illiquid, long-dated investments provides us with strong competitive advantages. I'll now hand over to Mark and Aaron. Thank you.
Thank you, Nigel, and good afternoon, everyone. We're now going to update you on our plans and progress for LGIM. Over the past several years, LGIM has delivered consistent, strong profit growth despite a challenging market environment and a complete transformation of our business model. We're experiencing positive net flows across virtually all regions, channels, and product areas. And although we've been investing for growth, we've maintained a stable margin of around 50% due to the scalable nature of our business model. We continue to grow our presence in the UK defined benefits sector as this market matures and increasingly implements de-risking strategies. And we're also successfully growing our market share in the defined contribution pension sector. Members of our workplace schemes have passed the 2 million mark and continue to increase. Growth in our retail business is also gaining momentum. This business was ranked 13th in the market when it was transferred to LGIM in 2014. We repositioned the business, and it was 6th in net sales last year and is on track to be top 5 this year. And our international expansion continues with growth in all target regions, especially the U.S. We'll focus on all these growth areas in more detail in later slides. The asset management industry has been going through a period of consolidation for the past several years, and this trend is continuing. The industry faces many well-publicized challenges, such as fee pressure in this low-yield environment, poor performance in many active funds, and several proposed actions to promote more competition in the recent interim FCA report. Despite these headwinds, LGIM has continued to forge ahead, significantly outperforming the broader industry. Since the financial crisis, global industry AUM has increased 37%, while our AUM is up 150%, all through organic growth. Net flows have been a fraction of pre-crisis levels, and many firms are experiencing net outflows. But we've had significant positive net inflows every year, with increasing diversification across regions, channels, and products. Industry profitability in 2015 is just slightly ahead of the 2007 level, while LGIM profit increased by 150% during this period. While there's a lot of attention on the challenges facing the asset management industry, it's important to also focus on how these challenges are creating opportunities for managers with the right business model, products, and distribution strategy. We're gaining market share because we've positioned our business to benefit from several positive industry trends. As these trends gain momentum, we believe LGIM will continue to experience sustained growth. There are four product areas in the asset management industry that are expanding: index, solutions, alternatives, and active specialties. And these four categories represent 94% of our assets. As defined benefit plans implement LDI strategies, and defined contribution schemes primarily seek a range of multi-asset and drawdown strategies, products broadly classified as solutions are experiencing significant growth. These products make up 46% of our assets, and this is the most rapidly growing part of our business. As the largest non-U.S. index manager, we're well positioned to grow our index business as the shift from active to passive continues. Index assets comprise 38% of our total assets. There's growing demand for a range of alternative strategies, including real assets. And while this is a fast-growing part of our business, we're taking steps to further accelerate the rate of growth. And the majority of our active strategies are in specialties that are experiencing rapid demand. We only have 6% of our assets in active core strategies, which are strategies primarily managed against market benchmarks. As you've seen, these types of strategies are experiencing fund outflows in the industry. We're winning because we're at the forefront and developing a comprehensive solutions approach across channels and regions. We're delivering consistent, strong results as we focus on a combination of three core strengths that differentiate LGIM from our peers: culture and client service, investment excellence, and our solutions approach. The strength of our culture and quality of our client service is demonstrated by our roughly 90% persistency rate year after year, and the fact that 55% of our defined benefit pension clients have been with us for over a decade. Our robust investment process has resulted in 88% of our flagship funds outperforming their respective benchmarks over the past 3 years. And our solutions approach allows us to design funds, execute efficiently, and successfully manage against our clients' objectives. These core strengths are responsible for our success in the UK DB market, where we have over 30% market share, and we're building on these strengths in markets where there is significant growth potential. Growth markets are now a material part of LGIM's business. More than 10% of our UK assets are in DC and retail, and nearly 20% of our total AUM is now from international clients. We're just getting started in these markets and have strong ambitions. We expect to be a top three provider in the defined contribution pensions in the UK, and international assets will continue to account for an increasing proportion of our total AUM. Now, I'll turn it over to Aaron Meter, who's our current head of investment and soon to become the CEO of LGIM America, to discuss each of these aspects of our value proposition in more detail.
Thank you, Mark. As Mark mentioned, one of our key points of differentiation is our client-centric culture. Just about every asset manager claims to be client-centric, but we believe the numbers here suggest we really understand what it takes. The first point I'll make is that we've invested heavily in our client-facing people. Not only the over 900 highly experienced client, sales, marketing, and support staff, but also the 120 investment solution specialists. These specialists work alongside our client teams to ensure the right level of dialogue with our clients, which has shifted from, look at this product, isn't it great, why don't you buy it, to let's make sure we really understand your problem, and then we can discuss how to leverage our full range of capabilities to help solve it. This client-centric and solutions-oriented culture has led to some impressive results. As Mark mentioned, we have high persistency levels and a very high percentage of long-term relationships. We also have a successful track record of transitioning clients from index assets to LDI solutions, active specialties, and beyond to self-sufficiency or buyout with LGR. This has resulted in 65% of defined benefit pension clients having multiple mandates with us. We also use surveys to ensure the client experience remains a competitive advantage for us. The survey results have been positive and consistent with our reputation in the market for reliability, trustworthiness, and doing the right thing. Moving on to our second point of differentiation, investment excellence. Whether a client has hired us to track an index, outperform a traditional benchmark, or manage an outcome-oriented solution, the numbers here demonstrate credibility to deliver against all of those objectives. Our index capabilities have consistently done what they say in the tin and track the index. This has led to a large number of happy clients that have evolved their mandate into active specialties and solutions. And we have delivered consistent, strong performance for our active clients, with 88% of funds outperforming over the past 3 years. Our fixed income team has either the top or near the top risk-adjusted long-term performance across U.S., sterling, and euro markets. Our equity and property teams have demonstrated consistent long-term outperformance. Our active LDI and multi-asset capabilities are relatively new, but now each has a 3-year track record of strong performance. Overall, our consistent track record demonstrates to clients that we have the skill necessary to help them achieve their objectives. And now the third point of competitive advantage, our solutions approach. For many years, we've been transforming our business model to focus on outcome-driven investment solutions alongside traditional mandates. 46% of our £842 billion in assets under management is now in a solutions approach across a range of investment strategies. The key to this is breaking down the investment silos that the traditional asset management business model was built on and combining capabilities together to bring clients the best of LGIM. We bring this to life via the 120 solution specialists I mentioned earlier, who first work with our client teams to understand the client's investment objective, and then second, work with our investment, insurance, and retirement teams to design the most effective solution. One increasingly common example of this would be combining our liability-driven investments and fixed income capabilities to deliver either a self-sufficiency or buyout-aware solution. Another example would be the 2016 launch of our fiduciary management service, which leverages our full breadth of investment capabilities and provides strategic advice to our UK DB clients. This solutions approach has led to a large amount of assets managed in solutions, but has also contributed to a very large business across index, fixed income, and real assets, and has helped to migrate assets to LGR via buyouts, as evidenced by the TRW and Rolls-Royce transactions. I'll now talk about how we are positioned across our core UK DB market, as well as our growth markets in DC, retail, and international. Starting with UK defined benefit market, we believe we are very well positioned for the continued de-risking of DB schemes. As the chart shows, this involves taking clients from traditional market benchmark strategies to liability-driven investment and multi-asset strategies, and as a scheme's funding level improves, we can then combine our LDI, credit, and real assets capabilities to take them to their end game destination, whether that be self-sufficiency or buyout. Our strong position in this market starts with our fundamental strength in the UK defined benefit market. We are the largest UK DB asset manager with a 32% market share. This started with being the market leader in index. We leveraged those relationships to become the market leader in liability-driven investment, where we developed one of the UK's first LDI strategies in 2001 and launched a range of pooled LDI funds in 2005. We are now the largest LDI manager in the UK with a 44% market share. Whether schemes are targeting self-sufficiency or buyouts, they will increasingly invest like an annuity fund. This is where our commitment to real assets and market-leading position in buyouts represent a significant opportunity for LGIM. We insure 3,000 pension schemes and are paying over 1 million pensions each year. LGIM is also well-placed to benefit from the rapid growth of the UK DC market, which is expanding by 12% per annum. LGIM has 15% market share, £50 billion in AUM, and 2 million members, all driving strong cash flows. We offer a full product suite across our investment-only and bundled solutions. We have a strong position in the fastest-growing bundled market, where we provide investment and administration to defined contribution schemes. This trend should mean greater persistency and increased revenue over time. By 2025, it is estimated that 80% of assets will be bundled. The Master Trust is our strategic bundled product for new DC business. Master Trusts are experiencing rapid growth. Spence Johnson estimates that Master Trust will capture 49% of DC members and 16% of DC assets by 2025. Trustee concerns over the fiduciary risks of offering drawdown mean that they are likely to favor Master Trust for retirement solutions. As a result of these trends, LGIM assets under administration have grown rapidly since launch with £2.4 billion in AUA, highlighted by the onboarding of schemes such as Tesco. As Mark mentioned, our retail business is also significantly increasing momentum. We are well placed to succeed given the long-term trends in the retail market, such as the rise of index funds. And the solutions approach is shifting from DB to DC to retail. We are seeing growth in the use of alternatives and high conviction active strategies, which is supportive of our focus on multi-asset solutions as well as real assets. And moving on to international expansion, our international business now accounts for a material and growing share of LGIM's business with 18% of our AUM. Our expansion into the U.S. has been a major success. We established ourselves in the U.S. in 2006 and started marketing our LDI and active fixed income capabilities to U.S. DB plans in 2010. Over the past 6 years, we've leveraged an outstanding active fixed income track record, a solutions approach, and more recently, our index capabilities to add 183 clients, approximately £100 billion of AUM, and firmly establish ourselves as a leading U.S. pension solutions provider. As U.S. pension funds are just getting started on their de-risking journey, there will be lots of opportunities to further grow our DB business. And there is opportunity to expand further into the U.S. There's a large amount of demand from U.S. and non-U.S. clients for direct investments to match long-dated liabilities. We are looking to expand our real assets capabilities to meet this demand. And the USDC market represents an incredibly large opportunity as well, with £10 trillion in AUM. We are already seeing demand for our index capabilities, and we are well positioned to offer a range of retirement income solutions as the USDC market continues to move in that direction. We are experiencing a steadily growing footprint in key European, Asian, and Gulf regions with £52 billion of AUM. We are expanding further into Japan and Latin America in 2017. In Japan, we have signed business cooperation agreements with Meiji and Nikko Asset Management, and in Latin America with Credit Corp.
So to sum all this up, we believe our client-centric culture, investment excellence, and solutions approach leave us very well positioned in our home market and internationally. The opportunity is huge. LGIM's strategic markets account for almost $20 trillion of AUM. Here in the UK, we're confident we can maintain our market-leading position as we take clients on their journey to their desired end-game destination of either self-sufficiency or buyout. We're well-positioned with a comprehensive set of solutions in the DC market and are performing strongly in retail. The FCA's focus on value for money and cost transparency will further improve our position across all UK markets. And internationally, we see a tremendous opportunity in the US across DB and DC channels, and more generally as a global DC pension solutions provider. I'll hand it over to Paul to talk about LGC.
Paul and Nora. Good afternoon. Thanks very much, Mark and Aaron. I'm delighted to update you on the progress of LGC. It's a rapidly growing division which is delivering significant profits to the group. And joining me is Laura Mason, who is the Director of Direct Investments. And in our presentation, we're going to cover what we do, why we operate in the areas we do, and the performance of the platform that we have built. LGC invests £6 billion of the group's shareholder funds. This is permanent capital supporting our long-term insurance businesses. We deliver sustainable and growing returns and provide valuable strategic opportunities for the group. The main investments are focused on three main sectors: housing, infrastructure, and finance for small and medium-sized businesses. These sectors are suffering a funding gap, which can be filled by long-term investors. And the role of LGC is to develop the means for investors to access these sectors directly. Our approach is to work with trusted partners with proven experience, where we add funding and financial expertise. We develop the asset or business platform and then bring in long-term investors before exiting. Given the nature of our investments, the group get access to these first, generating powerful synergies for the group. Since it was established in 2013 with the purchase of Cala Homes, LGC has established a successful track record. We have trebled the total direct investments to just over £1 billion, with investments in all key sectors. Laura will give you more detail on these investments and how we manage them shortly. LGC delivers profits and cash to the group. And to be clear on the point of profit before tax, the PBT on direct investments is based on the independent valuation of these assets, plus the actual trading revenues of the operating platforms. On this basis, direct investments have made a strong financial contribution, increasing PBT by 46%, from £35 million in the first half of 2015 to £51 million for the first half of 2016, 53% of which was from the operating entities. Overall, PBT for the traded and direct investment portfolio has increased by 75%, from £111 million to £195 million over the same period. We also deliver cash via dividends, coupons, and the sales of assets from the traded and direct investment portfolio. These combine to provide LGC with the means to contribute to the group dividend. We expect a greater proportion of the revenue to emerge from asset sales of direct investments in the future as our existing portfolio matures. At the half year, we had invested 18% of the funds in direct investments in all the three identified sectors. We do this in a disciplined way, ensuring that we meet the group liquidity ratios and within the scope of the group's capital strength. Our direct investments need to meet clear investment criteria, and we have two key financial targets. Firstly, we seek a return on our assets of between 10 and 12%. And secondly, a return on risk capital of at least 20%. We're also capital efficient. Overall, the traded and direct investment portfolio together represents just 6% of the group SCR. Therefore, we have scope to move more of our traded portfolio into direct investments and still meet these investment criteria. We also have the addition of a funding source of reinvesting the proceeds of direct investment sales. The combination of reinvesting sales and reallocating from traded assets provide LGC with significant scope to deliver growth. I shall now pass over to Laura, who will highlight the growth opportunity in our chosen sectors and give you more detail on the direct investments we've made so far.
Thank you, Paul, and good afternoon, everyone. The sectors we're focusing on give us opportunity, both in terms of a funding gap and the potential to build platforms that create assets for institutional investors. Looking first at the funding gap, the shortage of housing in the UK is well recognised, with an estimated £150 billion required to deliver the homes we need. In the regeneration space, we are aware of around £100 billion of investment that is needed across our towns and cities. According to the National Grid, to go green by 2020, around £40 billion is needed to secure a cleaner, cheaper, and more reliable energy system. And to ensure that the UK stays competitive on a global scale, British SME businesses need an estimated £125 billion. It is clear that the government and banks do not have capacity to meet these requirements, but that there is a wall of institutional money that does. The real asset investment opportunity is here, and institutional investors are changing their asset allocation accordingly. The graphs show these changing allocations, all moving to higher proportion of real assets from traditional traded portfolios. Legal & General is ideally placed to capture this asset allocation change. Moving on to our operating model, we focus on choosing partners who, firstly, have the necessary proven sector expertise, secondly, can bring us direct access to deal flow that we wouldn't otherwise see, and thirdly, where we can add real value by scaling the opportunity. We bring capital, but we also bring the financial expertise, corporate governance and management that are needed to grow these businesses and maximise their returns. This focus model has proved very successful. Looking at examples in each of our sectors, in housing, together with the Dutch Pension Fund, PGGM, and the Elgin Real Assets Division, we're investing £600 million to develop build-to-rent properties in the UK. Once income producing, they're sold to long-term income-seeking investors. In infrastructure, we partnered with the clean energy specialist NTR to launch an onshore wind construction fund. This €250 million fund closed earlier this year with two significant investments from large pension funds. And in urban regeneration, through our English Cities Fund, in partnership with the Homes and Communities Agency and a regional developer Muse, we have regenerated five sites in cities across the UK. This has also delivered a number of assets for LGR and Elgin's investment property funds. To support financing of SMEs, we've established a lending platform with the private debt specialist Pemberton, who have now closed their first fund at €1.2 billion providing debt financing to SMEs in the UK and Europe. Our partners are leaders in their sectors. Pemberton was awarded Global Newcomer of the Year in 2015. Muse has 30 years of urban regeneration experience and has won many awards for their work. And NTR has a 40-year track record in the infrastructure space. On this slide, we've listed our top 10 direct investments, the year we invested, and their current book value. Shown are some of the assets that I've just mentioned. And as you can see, the assets are diversified by sector, but also by geography. And these 10 represent almost 90% of our direct investment portfolio. We also have a strong pipeline, including many opportunities that have been brought to us by our current partners. This pipeline will deliver assets to us that meet our investment criteria. I'll now hand back to Paul to conclude.
Thank you, Laura. Looking at our platform, the core senior investment team consists of 29 specialist investment professionals with skills combining private equity, construction, asset management, and finance. Together, the team have an average of 20 years' experience in each of their fields. Our most recent joiner, Stephen Halliwell, for instance, was formerly CFO of 3i Infrastructure PLC. This team is also supported by our group risk and legal teams who have extensive capability. We have a rigorous governance process covering all our decisions with strict approval limits governing each transaction. A key part of our approval process is setting out how LGC and our partners manage and mitigate the operational, development and financial risk of each investment. All transactions, at the very least, go through LGC and group board executives for approval. Large transactions such as Media City and Cala have the additional requirement of being approved by a group board, ensuring stringent oversight is achieved. Now, Laura has already given some examples of our partnerships. The opportunities for synergies with the group are clear. One example is LGC's Cardiff project, one of the deals that has been completed as part of our Rio partnership with government. This transaction has great synergies with LGR and LNG Real Assets, drawing on their 30 years of property experience. It's a transformational redevelopment scheme in the centre of Cardiff. LGC partnered with the leading local developer, Rite Acres, in 2015 to build out the scheme and jointly control the site. There are two buildings being built, with LGC and Rite Acres having options on the rest of the site. LGC committed £37 million on the first building as an initial development. LGR was therefore able to access an attractive sale and leaseback on the second building, which is pre-let to BBC Wales on a 20-year lease. As you reach an acceptable level of pre-lets on each of the other buildings, we have the option to proceed, but importantly, no obligation. And in addition, LGM earns fees on any buildings which are owned by LGC and LGR. This example shows how we not only access the pipeline of assets for the group, but how we minimize the risk for LGC. So to conclude, we're focused on delivering higher risk-adjusted returns on shareholder funds. This will be done by increasingly redeploying capital from traded assets into direct investments, building on the profitable track record that we've established over the last 3 years, supporting the UK funding gap in housing, infrastructure, and the financing of small and medium-sized businesses, and remaining disciplined about our approach to investing. LGC has a huge opportunity to utilize Legal & General's unique combination of permanent capital in a leading investment institution. We see several sources of profit, growth from our activities in these sectors, and I'm confident that this will be enhanced and provide sustainable economic returns for our customers and shareholders alike. Thank you very much, and I now pass on to Kerrigan and Chris to talk about LGR.
Paul and Laura. In my 4 years heading up Legal and General Retirement, the retirement market has undergone significant change, most recently as a result of freedom and choice in pensions, and of course Solvency II. We've responded quickly to the challenges. Our response to freedom and choice was to launch a lifetime mortgage business on the 1st of April 2015. Since then, we have originated £719 million of lifetime mortgage loans, with £518 million year-to-date. Our response to Solvency II for UK pension risk transfer was to move to a capital-efficient approach. Year-to-date, we have written £6.9 billion of annuity business, with total Solvency II capital strain of less than £200 million. The UK pension risk transfer growth opportunity is huge, and we are uniquely well positioned to capitalise on this opportunity. However, we are also keen to export our expertise to the US, where a similar opportunity exists. We're making good progress in this market and have closed 5 deals so far this year. LGR has achieved strong profit growth, but as you have heard, we've only got there with a lot of help from our friends. Anton talked about how LGIM's active fixed income and real assets teams manage LGR's assets. Aaron covered LGIM's incredible connections with defined benefit pension clients. Bernie talked about the diversification benefit of writing mortality risk in the insurance business alongside longevity risk in the retirement business. And Paul covered how LGC put shareholder funds to work to not only achieve excellent returns, but also to provide relevant investment opportunities for LGR. L&G's whole is truly greater than the sum of its parts. We have a market-leading retirement business covering global pension risk transfer, UK individual annuities, and UK lifetime mortgages. We have guaranteed a pension for life for over 1 million people, and we hold £51 billion of assets to back these promises. The scale of our balance sheet means that we're able to use the capital release as the book runs off to fund our new business growth while contributing to the group's distributable surplus. We entered the pension risk transfer business in 1987, and since then have written over 1,600 bulk annuity deals and hold £32 billion of reserves to back those defined benefit pension liabilities. Pension risk transfer business can be lumpy, but if you look across the last 3 years, we have just under one-third of the UK pension risk transfer market. We've accumulated a vast quantity of longevity data from our 30 years in the PRT business, and we support a 25-person strong longevity science team able to extract the information hidden within this data. Furthermore, we have extensive links into scientific research to help us understand long-term trends in morbidity and mortality. Put together, we believe we have superior longevity science intellectual property for defined benefit pensions. The success of our colleagues in LGIM in the defined benefit pension market means that Legal & General has an ongoing relationship with almost 50% of the nearly 6,000 possible UK defined benefit pension customers. This is a notable competitive advantage relative to our peers. Chris Knight, LGR's CFO, is now going to take you through the next section.
Thank you, Kerrigan. In Kerrigan's 4 years, we have grown assets by 14% per annum and operating profits by 32% per annum. As a management team and with all the growth opportunities we see, our aim is to continue to grow the business in scale and to grow profits faster than assets. With the demise of the secondary annuity market, we now have 8, not 9, sources of profit. The benefits of this diversified model is truly apparent when you consider that we have continued the development of the business despite events such as the loss of much of the individual market, the advent of Solvency II, and falling real interest rates. Our £51 billion back book is a wonderful platform to have. It gives us around £10 billion of undiscounted future profits, which will be declared over the next 60 years. And we have added significantly to that stock of future profits already in 2016. This year, the Aegon individual annuity portfolio acquisition has been matched with £3 billion of pension risk transfer sales. And we are once again seeing growth in our own individual annuity business. Our entry into the lifetime mortgage market last year has been cemented this year. We have led the market in pricing, product design, service standards, and customer focus. Our nascent U.S. business has written more deals this year, and we have added capability to our Bermuda reinsurance operations. We still see the U.K. PRT market as a major growth opportunity for LGR and the group. As well as further back book consolidation opportunities, there remains a very strong pipeline of new business out there. At the end of 2015, U.K. private sector defined benefit pension liabilities totaled £2.1 trillion. Of this £2.1 trillion, we estimate only around 5% has gone all the way through to buy-in or buy-out. Even in challenging economic conditions, we have seen the flow of PRT deals push through the £10 billion per annum floor. With two-thirds of the large pension funds surveyed saying they intended to use pension risk transfer solutions in the next 5 years, we are confident that this trend will continue. The funds that are typically most ready to transact are those that have already begun their de-risking journey, hedging their inflation and interest rate exposure via LDI mandates. There is roughly £750 billion of assets in this position, of which around a half has been de-risked with the help of Elgin. Legal & General is uniquely positioned to help pension funds across all stages of the de-risking journey. The £2.5 billion TRW buyout we completed in 2014 and the £1.1 billion buyout with Rolls-Royce that we announced last month are perfect examples of clients that began with investment de-risking journey with Elgin, coincidentally both in 2007, and completed it with buyouts from Legal & General Retirement. So it's clear that the demand for UK pension risk transfer remains strong and that we are well positioned to access the opportunity. What I want to convey to you in the next section of our presentation is that we have successfully leveraged our market position and our intellectual property to address the Solvency II challenges. This is enabling us to deliver low single-digit new business Solvency II strains when expressed as a percentage of premium on typical pension risk transfer deals. We are therefore confident that we can continue to meet the demand for pension risk transfer solutions. Now, to explain the charts in more detail. The charts represent what has been a typical PRT deal in 2016, excluding Aegon, although under many metrics, the Aegon deal was not significantly different from a typical front book deal. For a typical deal, we expect the difference between our premium and the best estimate liability value to be in the high single digits when expressed as a percentage of the premium. Under IFRS, we only take a small amount of this profit up front, with the rest being released in future years as our prudence margins unwind. If we just applied the old Solvency I mode of doing business, with no direct investment, an A-minus credit portfolio, and no longevity reinsurance, we would get a strain under Solvency II of perhaps in excess of 20%. However, with selective DI, more like an A-plus credit portfolio, 80% longevity reinsurance, and recent pricing, we get back to a low single-digit strain. Indeed, not so very far off the capital strain under Solvency I. Again, we don't see a huge difference in the final result between back book and front book deals, with the transitional allowance for a back book deal removing the need for longevity reinsurance, and the pricing adjusting to reflect the cost of Solvency II capital. If you look at it from a margin perspective, we again see that the adjustments to the model have more or less completely offset the cost of the additional Solvency II capital requirements in 2016. In the next few slides, we'll cover in a little more detail the expertise we've drawn on to allow us to deliver such fantastic financial results. We are market-leading pension risk transfer experts with a 25-strong team of highly qualified longevity professionals who dedicate their time to researching and understanding at a very granular level longevity experience and future trends. We have been collecting and analyzing longevity data for over 30 years. Even considering only the last 5 years, we have over 16 million person years of experience data, which covers a wide range of socioeconomic and occupational classes in the US and the UK. This data is specifically useful for the PRT business, which is where the huge opportunities are. Recent years have seen levels of mortality which have diverted from the ever downward trend line, which is already priced into our offering. Time will tell whether this is a temporary divergence or a more sustained change in trend. The latter would be a very material positive for us, although we do not feel the need to rush to judgment on the issue. On the previous slide, we showed our approach to understanding the longevity risk to which we are exposed. This is essential when it comes to gaining competitive advantage in pricing and also when engaging with the reinsurance market and selecting the risks we wish to offload. Prior to Solvency II, we were less active when it came to reinsuring our longevity risk in comparison to our peers. We understood the risk, we were rewarded for it, so it made sense to keep it. Now, wind forward to Solvency II, and we are no longer as rewarded for holding longevity risk because the burden of the risk margin is too great, at least for the time being. Reinsurance is therefore an essential tool for managing the Solvency II new business strain. And in anticipation of Solvency II, we significantly ramped up our reinsurance capability and now reinsure circa 80% of our new business longevity exposure and about a quarter of our back book. We have extensive relationships with all the major reinsurers, both through our retirement business and our protection business, and have seen capacity strengthen with new reinsurers coming into the market and others expanding the range of risks they are willing to reinsure. We have concluded automatic and bespoke reinsurance treaties split by scheme size. We have the ability to reinsure any combination of immediate and deferred annuity risk and to reinsure asset exposure. We draw the analogy with the very uneconomic XXX capital rules which were inflicted on the US term insurance industry in the early 2000s. In that market, we led the implementation of ever more cost-effective and capital-efficient solutions over time. We have been successful there, and we expect to be successful here. We are confident that both the capacity in the market and the strength of our relationships will ensure we can continue to adopt an economically attractive and capital-efficient strategy for many years to come. I'll now hand back to Kerrigan.
Thanks, Chris. Chris has covered how our longevity risk management expertise has enabled us to continue to participate effectively in the market under the new regulatory capital regime. Earlier, Anton covered the high level of diversification by issuer, sector, and geography within the asset portfolio, and talked about LGIM's risk-aware approach to managing the portfolio credit risk. This leads me to delve into LGR's direct investment portfolio in more detail. The self-manufacture of assets to create new, real, productive assets is a cornerstone of our investment philosophy. With our balance sheet size and the long-term nature of our liabilities, we are able to invest for a size and term that differentiates us from many other investors and allows LNG to get directly involved in the structuring of the assets. This is good for our pensioners, since the assets provide long-term reliable cash flows to back pension promises. It's good for the economy, as it helps provide jobs and supports economic growth. This is good for our shareholders, as we earn an illiquidity premium over tradable bonds. Our direct investments to date are generally managed by LGIM and involve leases to high-quality tenants, with the underlying property as additional security, direct lending to companies secured on property, or bespoke lending into infrastructure deals. A strategic investment by LGC can sometimes be the catalyst for a further LGR investment in a debt-like asset. The Cardiff City Centre investment described by Paul earlier is a good example of this. Or LGR can develop assets directly, such as the origination of lifetime mortgage loans through its lifetime mortgage business. Salient features of all these forms of LGR direct investment are cash flows to match pension payments, earning an illiquidity premium over tradable bonds, and coming with strong security or collateral. To date, LGR have over £8.2 billion invested in this way. We've shown here the top 10 direct investment holdings. The portfolio has an average A-minus rating, similar to the rest of the annuity book. All of the properties are occupied with long-term leases. We have not yet had any tenant or borrower defaults. To give some feel for the portfolio, I'll give a bit of detail on one of our student accommodation assets and one of our infrastructure assets. The development funding we provided for Imperial College's postgrad studio apartments near Clapham Junction is a great example of one of our investments in student housing. It has a strong credit rating. Imperial is ranked the number 4 university in the UK and number 9 globally, and has a large London asset base. The probability of default is low. We structured the deal as an income strip, meaning we're able to treat the asset as a debt on our balance sheet with no residual property risk. Moving on to our investment in the London Gateway. This is a deep water port 25 miles from the centre of London that is able to handle ultra-large container vessels. These are expected to become 80% of the global shipping fleet. Just to look a little bit more into the investment, berths 1 and 2 were completed in December 2013, and the port has been fully operational since then. The funds we provided this year were used to refinance existing debt and finance the berth 3 construction work, which has now completed. This asset provides us with strong, stable cash flows, and we will be applying for better Solvency II treatment for infrastructure assets in 2017. This is also a great example of where we have worked closely with our LGIM colleagues who sourced the asset and negotiated strong structural protections over many months. Now on to lifetime mortgages. This has been one of our great success stories this year, highlighted earlier. Our rationale for entering this market was twofold. Firstly, we wanted to provide our customers with more freedom and choice when it came to funding their retirement. With more than £1.5 trillion of housing equity owned by the over 55s, it was clear to us that this had to form part of any future retirement proposition. Growth opportunity in this market is huge, perhaps in the region of 25% per annum. Second reason why this market is so important to us is that it provides us with another long-term asset that matches our liabilities well and provides a value uplift versus tradable bonds. As we are using our annuity customers' money to fund our lifetime mortgage lending, we are, of course, very cautious about the risk that we take. The typical loan we offer is 70K to a 70-year-old with a loan-to-value of no more than 40%. This would allow for something like a 20% immediate house price fall, followed by house price inflation of around 1.5% per annum for the life of the mortgage before our negative equity guarantee bites. Our portfolio is diversified across Great Britain. This is a great product for our retirement customers and a great asset for our balance sheet. Chris and I have hopefully given you a good insight into the way in which we manage our UK business and how we've continued to adapt to the regulatory changes that have come to play. The US has public defined benefit pension liabilities of $3.2 trillion, and there is a further $2 trillion if we take into account Canada, Netherlands, and other European countries. Whilst, of course, each market has its own nuances, fundamentally, the expertise and skills required to play in these markets are the same as those we have demonstrated in the UK. Our annuity operations were established at L&G Re in 2013, and then in 2015 in the US. Since then, we have continued to build out our teams and capabilities, and we were delighted to land our first deals in both the Netherlands and in the US in 2015. Since then, we have added a further 5 deals in the US this year. I'm really optimistic about the future potential for our growth in these markets, and that we will be able to replicate the continuing success that we've enjoyed in the UK. Thank you for your time, and now back to Nigel.
And thank you to all the team for their excellent presentations today. I've got just a couple of things to wrap up with. First, why we're winning. I think you'll understand why we're winning, having seen the quality of the management team today. I feel very privileged to be the chief executive of L&G because I managed to work with such outstanding individuals. Perhaps more importantly, they regard themselves as a team. What differentiates us and what is unique, I think, to L&G is the teamwork. And you see that teamwork today being expressed in many different ways. The second thing is the future growth. And I'm really, really excited about the team's capability to drive future growth in this business. Aaron's going back to the United States. I have absolute confidence that the huge opportunities that we'll see there, he will be talking about them next year. Bernie's been giving it large about how much success he can have in America. He's been coming with me on the last 2 or 3 trips to the US, and we can see huge opportunities there. You heard from Chris and from Kerrigan about the great opportunities that exist
in the LGR space, not just in the UK, but also in the United States and the rest of the world. And LGC, in the last 3 years, has got off to a great start. We've identified three growth markets, and we're executing incredibly well. That's why we've managed to deliver a 20% return on equity and have driven cash and earnings so well over the last few years. I'll now hand over to questions. Who wants to go first? John Hocking, perhaps. I hope it's the same question, John, because they've been practicing the answer.
It's a slightly different one. So you've got two questions, please. Could you just talk broadly about how you think about the risk appetite the group has for annuities? So what proportion of liabilities you're comfortable with? What are those? Because obviously more tail risk in that business than there is in the rest of the book. How you think about sustainability of cash flow, capital, et cetera? It's the first question. And then sort of linked, how do you think about sort of bridging the gap between what you see as the economic view in terms of pricing and what Solvency II allows you to do? So particularly in terms of the matching adjustment constraints, equity release, how you think about the economics of that versus the Solvency II and how you manage that?
Yeah, both excellent questions. I'll get Simon to just talk about the overall group risk appetite and where annuities fit within that, and then Kerrigan, if you answer the bits that Simon left out and also answer the very tricky second question.
So, I represented the current balance of risk on our balance sheet. It's fair to say that credit risk and market risk already have a significant proportion. The plans that we have in Kerrigan's business, clearly there is a scope still to increase that. Our balance sheet has the potential to do that. But there's plenty of other businesses that you've heard about this afternoon that add top line to the coverage ratio, add our own funds without particularly adding to the bottom line the SCR. So we would like to grow the balance sheet in a more balanced way, which is why the syndicated model that we've moved towards is going to be a bigger part of the future. But from a capital perspective, we have plenty of headroom still to be able to grow the annuity business.
On the flow, I was very happy with the 2.7 billion of annuity business that we wrote last year, 2015, and very happy with the 6.9 billion year to date this year. As long as we continue writing it low to mid single digit strains, which we expect to do, then I think we'll keep to meet Mark's view that over the medium term, no worse than net neutral surplus generation. So that's a great picture of the room. We're pretty confident of continuing that approach. In none of those conversations does anything about the spot, the current coverage ratio come into play. So confident about that growth in those markets. And I think really, linking to Simon's point, that I made the point in my speech that the whole of L&G is greater than the sum of the parts. It works well as a diversified insurer, and we're keen to continue that. And you've seen that today from the other conversations with the other divisions.
Okay, any more questions? Andrew.
Yes, I've got three questions if I can. You've mentioned or given a growth rate over the next 5 years for net surplus generation of mid to high single digits, so 7 to 9%. Would you expect cash generation, therefore dividends, to grow at a similar rate? Secondly, could I ask on the annuity business which has been written this year, what is the impact on the coverage ratio, or put another way, can you give us the numerator and denominator which adds up to that less than 200 million surplus impact? And then thirdly, again on the annuity business, could you say what your target for as a percentage of the total annuity portfolio you'd want for infrastructure or direct investment and lifetime mortgages, and how that would lift the overall yield on the portfolio?
Gosh, those are all excellent questions. I'm just trying to decide which of my colleagues is worthy of answering those questions. I've had instructions off Mark not to answer the first question, as I will give a very explicit answer to the first question. Mark's going to give a less explicit answer to the first question. And Kerrigan answers, and Chris between them answer the second and third question.
Just first point of clarification, Andrew. When I used mid to high single digit, I'm not quite translate to 7 to 9. I feel like you're rounding up. It's a bit like my colleague on my left. He can round up any number, so can you, it seems. So So just go and retranslate that comment. Clearly, in terms of dividend, it's a board decision. Clearly, we have our progressive dividend policy in existence. Now, clearly, we see lots of growth opportunities for the group, but we're very keen to make sure we have sustainable growing dividend as well. So you have to wait for that one for March and beyond to get more details on that.
We're all sharing the mic.
Your second, no, it's not working. Slide 80. Use there to come up with some. So we said that the difference between the premium and the best estimate liabilities under Solvency II was in the high single digits. We said that our strain after paying for SCR and the remnants of the risk margin after we've done 80% longevity reinsurance, we're looking at low single digit strain. We've said 2 to 3% for 2016. So I think the gap there gives you the answer for roughly what the SCR is. But obviously, they differ very much by deal. So that's an average. And we've seen, as things have progressed over the year, an evolution in pricing and in market terms of trade. Answer your third question. I think roughly a third in terms of our proportion of total DI and lifetime mortgage assets over a long period of time. It'll be what it is, I guess, in the market.
North of 100 basis points. North of 100 basis points.
North of 100 basis points. Thank you.
Greg? We're determined to finish by 5:30, so everybody can have an informal drink afterwards and ask whatever other questions they've got.
I was enjoying the fact that they brought the mic over for me to answer management's questions. This shows confidence in my insights. Thank you. I've actually got four questions, and you can answer them briefly if you want. One is digital, and I appreciate you've got initiatives at play, but I hear the same story from Aviva, and I hear the same story from the various European players. To me, there's a margin compression theme going on there. I wonder if you just want to discuss to what extent you've experienced that as these digital benefits get competed away. Second question, lifetime mortgages. If you go and look at MoneyFax, I think your teaser rate is 3.7, and that compares to 5.5 for JRP and I think 5% of Aviva. So it's very aggressive pricing. I was wondering if that's just a short-term strategy, you're going to pull back your pricing to your peers, or you feel that you'll just carry on and they must move to your levels. The third thing is, if you look at the, and please excuse, I might have got this wrong because of seasonality, but if you take the first half of your asset management profit and you annualize it, it doesn't look like your asset management business is growing its profits this year. And obviously there's a challenge between trying to expand your capacity and versus growing the top for long-term versus the top line. I wonder if you can talk about those jaws and your expectations for those jaws. As a final point, a key element that has arisen recently in your P&L is the LGC. But when you look at the subcomponents of LG profits, even the operating profit, you've got the numbers jumping around quite materially now that we've seen the breakdown. I was wondering if you expect an aggregate to have a sort of stable operating profit growth going forward on that, i.e. its contribution to IFRS and NCG, or is that going to jump around a lot?
That's a new record for questions from Greg. And I think, Bernie, do you answer questions one and two? Mark, can you answer three? And Paul, four? Thank you. The answer for one is, by the way, we have no compression.
Digital is one of those unstoppable, one of the six unstoppable trends, and you have to be on there, and you can't be complacent. What we've experienced, particularly in the UK retail protection, is fairly consistent margins over a long period of time and good healthy margins over quite a considerable period of time. But that is a factor of continually innovating, continuing to push on, sharing some of that with the customer and maintaining good healthy profit margins.
Lifetime mortgages, you can answer that one?
Sorry, I didn't pick up on that one. I've kind of moved on, Nigel. What was the question again, Greg? Yes, yeah, so, it is currently a pretty price sensitive market, and we've got to always balance up. Clearly we want to write lifetime mortgages at a good yield. We're constantly reevaluating that as gilt yields move and or asset yields move, and to make sure we strike the right balance there.
I think in general you'll always find us as a pretty price competitive, whether it's in the annuity business, individual annuity business, wherever there's any open market competition. I think the differential in price that you're referring to is much smaller than that when you do a like for like across all product sectors. And I think we'd be marginally cheaper than Aviva, but not much cheaper than Aviva over a period of time, Greg. I think you'll find both us and Aviva will be competitive in the lifetime mortgage market, as indeed we are in other markets, and similarly for individual annuity markets, and definitely in the ALGIM space, where we've always been very competitive on pricing. Hence, we built huge industrial scale in our business. Over to you, Mark.
In regards to your question on the ALGIM profitability the first half of the year, so obviously our profit's going to be large, our revenue is going to be largely driven by asset values. Asset markets got off to a very difficult start to the year. There's a significant sell-off, if you recall, back the first 2 months of the year, which impacted not just us, but the whole industry. But ultimately, in looking longer term, things we can influence and have greater control over would be fund performance and the quality of our products and customer service and so forth. And that ultimately leads to net inflows for us, again, across basically all of our core channels and regions and product areas in the first half of the year, and that compounds over time. So really, you can't really just annualize the first half of the year because asset markets have obviously recovered since then.
So he's going to do better in the second half than he did in the first half, was the kind of answer to that. Romy, Paul? Yeah. Are you mic'd up, Mark?
Our expectation is the portfolio will become more obviously direct investments than traded, and the traded portfolios by their nature will have much more volatile profits than the direct investments, and they've also got a lower return than direct investments. So our view is that they will increase and become more stable over time, and I think that as the portfolio becomes bigger, there's going to be a diversity of assets coming through in terms of their maturity to realize those profits, bearing in mind that it has been ongoing for about two or three years, and therefore a number of the projects we've started, like Cardiff and others, are really at the start of their journey. So I would say increased and more stable is what you should expect.
Okay. Andy.
Hi, thanks so much. Andy Hughes from Macquarie. A couple of questions if I could. One about LGC. And I'm trying to understand the return on SCR metric of 20%, because it seems like it's only 1.6% a year, because your SCR is 6% of the group SCR. So I'm wondering, is that really a valid metric, and how does that work, and which of these metrics that you've listed here are the most important for different parts of the business? And the second question is LGC. Obviously, you highlighted the recent mortality trend. On LGR, you highlighted the recent mortality trend over the last 5 years with very limited improvements. And obviously, that's factored into the reinsurance pricing you're getting. Presumably, the reinsurers are looking at that in a different way to the way you are. So if you're right, does the reinsurance capacity dry up in delaying putting these changes through? Or if the other way goes and it goes in your favor, aren't you losing a lot of mortality profits by reinsuring the risk anyway? Thank you.
Kerrigan, do you want to answer the second question? Paul, can we do the maths between now and when you talk to Andy afterwards as to how that works out?
Yeah, I think the whole industry, and Simon mentioned it earlier in his speech, that longevity developments happen very slowly over a long period of time. We understand that. We understand that we need to take our time over deciding whether it's a blip or a change in trend. All the reinsurers understand that pretty well too. So our job is to go to that reinsurance market, make sure that they've taken as much account as possible of that trend, get the best price out of them, make sure we understand where our pricing is and our reserving is, both if it is a blip or if it is a trend. And we've done a really good job at executing with that big pool of reinsurers on that basis. So we understand and they understand, and we work well together on that basis. I don't think there's any let up in potential reinsurance capacity that we have at least 13 reinsurers on our panel they're all really hungry for more business, and we can get good competitive tension, whatever the deal that we're looking at. So none of that picture. You have to understand what you're doing, of course, and the reinsurers do, we do, and none of that picture worries me in terms of potential growth and capacity in that market.
I said to everyone that we'd finish at 5:30, and we're right at 5. Oh, there's one more question. Oh, right. Sorry. One last question.
Well, just it's Trevor Moss from Berenberg. I just thought I might invite you, Nigel, or perhaps Bernie, to discuss what you're thinking in terms of rolling out the retail protection strategy in the US. You didn't really talk about it. You talked about wanting to do it. You didn't really talk about what you were going to do.
Well, I think we'll cover that. We haven't yet done the presentation to the board. I think Bernie's actually going to do it. I can't remember if it was in January or February. He's had three visits so far with me over there. So it's a bit premature, I think, even for Bernie to come forward with lots of ideas. We just wanted to let you know that's what we're doing. We've reorganized the business. And, you know, maybe afterwards Bernie can talk about some of the initial working hypothesis that him and John have developed. But we'll cover it in a lot more detail when we do the year-end results in March. I'd just like to say thank you for everyone for your attention. We've done covered a lot of material very quickly. We were told that's what would meet the needs of the audience today after some of the very long sessions you've done in previous days like this. And we're welcoming you all to a drink in next door. So if you move next door, there's some drinks, and thank you again.